Okay, so thanks for the introduction and also thanks to the organizers for giving me the opportunity to speak here. So I'm gonna give you some first application of the Hopf algebraic structures we just heard about. Namely, I'll show you how to apply them to generalize the Kitaev Terracotta model. So first I'll give you a start with a quick recap on the Terracotta. Then I reintroduce the Hopf algebras using tensor network notation and also introduce this additional C-star structure that we need. Then I'll define the quantum double models via its placket and vertex symmetries and show you how this gives rise to excitations that are described by the quantum double algebra. And in the end, I will also look at the operators that create excitations. Okay. So the Kitaev Terracotta is a quantum spin system with one qubit associated to each edge of some lattice. I put here a square lattice, but it could be any even irregular lattice. And I will draw the computational basis states just by coloring each edge with the according spin in the up state red and not coloring all other edges. So this would be kind of one computational basis configuration. Another ground state is just an equivalent superposition of all closed loop configurations in this language. So this basis state configuration would occur in the ground state wave function, but also this is a closed loop superposition and would occur with the same amplitude. And I can describe the same state by just giving two symmetries. So first, there is this closed loop constraint, which means that at every vertex of the lattice, I have to impose that the number of red edges adjacent to the vertex is even. So that's kind of a C2 symmetry. And also, if I add a small loop around one plaquette, like here, so if I flip all the spins around one plaquette, then the amplitude doesn't change. And this is another C2 symmetry. So now I might not only be interested in ground state properties, but also like thermal properties or so. For this, I have to consider so-called excitations. Those are states which look like the ground state at most places, but differ from it at some places. And because there are two kinds of symmetry, there are also two kinds of violations of those symmetries, or two kinds of excitations. So on the one hand, there are electric excitation, which violate this closed loop constraint. So a wave function with an electric excitation at this blue dot here would be just like the superposition of all closed loop patterns that have a string end at this blue point. And there is also a violation of the placket constraint, which is called magnetic excitation. So if you have a excitation like this at some placket, then if you flip the spins around this placket, you will get a sine factor of -1 instead, just getting the same state. So now it seems like this picture of fluctuating strings is at least qualitatively correct to describe any kind of topological order in 2D. But in order to also make it quantitatively correct, we have to generalize, of course, from C2 symmetries to more general symmetries. And one straightforward way of doing so is to, instead of put qubits on the edges, so that is local degrees of freedom whose basis vector states are labeled by the group C2. Instead of this, we take local vector spaces that whose basis states are labeled by some arbitrary group G. And then the vertex constraint would be imposing that the product of all group elements around one vertex is the identity group element. And instead of flipping spins around one placket, one would multiply all spins around that placket by one and the same group element. But it turns out that this is not yet the most general generalization. So there are, for example, the famous string net models by Lau and Wen. There one goes from groups to unitary fusion categories. there is also a second generalization, and this consists of taking instead of group hopped algebras, and in particular, if one takes like weak hop C-star algebras, then one gets models that are even equivalent to the string net models. But I'm not going to talk about the general case of weak hop C-star algebras. So Liang Chang will talk about this later this week and also about this connection here, I guess. I will concentrate on the case of hop C-star algebras because there the parallels to group symmetry are still a bit more visible. And those kind of models have the nice additional structure that they show in a nice way this duality between the placket and the vertex constraint. So these two symmetries are described on equal footing. Okay, so let's start with hop algebras. Hop algebra consists of five objects, which are all linear maps that map from some 0, 1, or 2 copies of some vector space to, again, 0, 1, or 2 copies of this vector space. And I will only consider finite dimensional and complex vector spaces, so I can write them as c to the power of some index at h. And I will use tensor network notation, also known as Penrose notation, to denote those objects. So the tensor itself will be denoted by some shape. Here I chose this empty half disk. And each index of the tensor will be denoted by just a line sticking out of the shape. So for example, the unit eta here is just a vector in this vector space with, so it is this tensor which has one index. And the multiplication mu is just a tensor with three indices, two kinds of input indices and one output index. So this is the algebra part of the Hopf algebra. And there is also this co-algebra part. So this co-unit, which is again like a vector, but in the dual vector space. But as we are in finite dimension, there is no real need to distinguish the dual and the vector space. And also this co-multiplication here. OK, those tensors together would form a bi-algebra with the accordion axioms. In order to make it a Hopf algebra, I need this additional antipode, which is kind of an involution for both parts, the algebra part and the co-algebra part. That's why I draw it here by simply a triangle that is half filled and half empty. And don't be confused that I use the same symbol here and here. So those are still different tensors because they have a different number of legs. So now I can just replace groups by Hopf algebras and try to construct quantum models out of that, but I will find that there is something missing because in quantum mechanics, time evolution is always unitary, or equivalently, Hamiltonians should always be self-adjoint. And in order to guarantee this, we need some additional structure, which is given by some adjoint operation on the vector space, which is actually an antilinear operation, so it's not really a tensor on this complex vector space level, but if we kind of interpret complex numbers as vectors consisting of real and imaginary power, then I can still think of this as just a tensor on this level. And now it might seem like this additional thing is something that makes everything actually a little bit more complicated and that even destroys this nice duality between the algebra and the co-algebra part. But I'll show you in a minute that actually rather the opposite is the case. But first, let us look at the Hopf algebra axioms in this Penrose notation. So all of the axioms were like those commutative diagrams. So they were equations between different ways of connecting those linear maps together. And multiplication of linear maps is nothing but a contraction over the corresponding indices of the matrices describing that. And in Penrose notation, contraction over two indices is just given by connecting the lines corresponding to the index. So for example, if I concat the multiplication with the co-unit, this corresponds to this diagram here, where I take the output index of the multiplication and put it in in the co-unit. And this equals just twice the co-multiplication here. Or then I have also this axiom that if I put the output index of the unit into the co-multiplication, then I get twice the unit. Then if I connect the unit with the co-unit, then I just get one. And also this bi-algebra axiom that the delta map is an algebra map can be expressed in this way. And then because I have a Hopf algebra, I also need some axiom involving this antipode S, which just looks like this. And then in addition, for kind of the algebra and the co-algebra itself, I would also have this associativity axiom and that the unit multiplies trivially. And those can also be expressed in that way. I just didn't put them here. So then I also introduced this adjoint operation, which has to make together with the multiplication and the unit a C star algebra. But that's not all. I also need some compatibility between the co-multiplication and the adjoint, which is given by this equation here. It just means that the adjoint operation commutes with the co-multiplication. Okay. So now I promised you that the star structure would actually make everything a bit more simpler. To see this, I'll do a slight change of notation. Because so far we kind of distinguished between like input and output indices and only connected input indices to output indices. But now what this adjoint operation does, it kind of maps between vector space and the dual vector space. So it kind of transforms output indices into input indices and vice versa. And so I can take this multiplication map, which kind of had one special index because it's an output index, and apply this adjoint operation to this index. And then I get some new tensor, which has somehow three output indices. So I can treat them on equal footing. And I can even choose a gauge where this tensor has symmetry under cyclic commutation of indices. And also, for the adjoint and the unit, I just put now this round symbols for the tensor.
Sorry.
Yeah?
What do you mean by inputs and
outputs? I mean, so far we have kind of thought of those at as linear maps, going from some vector space to another vector space.
So we're going from top to bottom.
Yeah. And now we stop thinking about that. Just, yeah. We stop distinguishing between
input and output. That unification requires an inner product on your vector space, you know?
Again?
That requires an inner product on your vector space, identifying covariant tensor
yeah.
contravariant ones. So what is your inner product?
The inner, I mean, kind of this adjoint operation is the inner product in some sense.
But that's a linear map, no? It goes from the space to itself.
Yeah, but in this way of thinking, if you want to take the inner product between two vectors, then you just put the adjoint operation between them and simply contract. So the adjoint operation.
What do you mean by contract? I can contract a contravariant index with a covariant one, but I don't have.
So the adjoint operation is exactly this that makes a contraction possible. It's kind of a metric. So this has kind of two contravariant indices. And because of this, I can contract it with two vectors that both have covariant indices.
Okay, but if you've thrown it with an input and an output, so it looks like it has a contravariant and a covariant.
Ah, sorry. No, the thing.
You should. Map on the algebra, right?
An anti-unitary map, anti-linear map, and because of this. I should think of this as having two output indices or two input indices, whatever you like. Yeah, that's how it is.
Okay. Another question, what precisely do you mean by choosing a gauge?
So you can just do any linear map on the vector space, so redefine your basis. So this.
Basis choice.
Yeah, just a basis change by some invertible map S. Okay. And the same thing I can also do with the co-algebra structure using some results from the general theory of Hopf algebras. So first, if I have a C Hopf C star algebra, then by some miracle it's automatically guaranteed that the adjoint, the antipode is an involution. So we also heard this morning. And also that the antipode commutes with the adjoint operation. And because of this, the product of the two is again an involution, and it's an antilinear involution. And this involution serves as an adjoint operation for the co-algebra. And if I now take this involution to kind of convert the special index of the co-multiplication to also an output indices, then I also get the co-multiplication with three indices that can be treated on equal footing. Okay, so now I not only recover this nice duality between the algebra structure and the co-algebra structure, but I also get this invariance under cyclic permutations. And what I also get is that kind of those tensors can be seen as different versions of the same thing, just with a different number of legs. And so I can also construct versions of this tensor with even more legs, like four legs, by simply fusing those tensors together. And when I fuse them together by contracting them, then I, of course, have to put this metric tensor in between, such that I can contract between kind of two contravariant index, if you wish. Okay, and the same is also valid for the co-algebra part. So now I show you in a minute how the axioms look like actually for this kind of language, but I'd first like to give you some physical interpretation of those tensors. So I kind of have now two C star algebras, and I can go to the block diagonal basis of each of them, and then I get two bases, and the two bases have physical interpretation. So first, the bases where the co-algebra is block diagonal, those basis elements correspond to symmetry operation, and the basis where the algebra is block diagonal corresponds to particles, so violations of a symmetry, or also called excitations. Okay, and so the unit is nothing but a trivial symmetry operation by definition, but it also has an interpretation in terms of particles. It just is a superposition of all different kinds of particle. And so that means if you project on any way the symmetry can be violated, then you just do nothing at all. And the co-unit is nothing but the trivial particle, but it also has an interpretation in terms of symmetry, just a superposition of all symmetry operations. So if you average over all symmetry operation, then you get nothing that the projection on the trivial invariant sector, so on the trivial particle. Also those adjoint operations have some interpretation. So the product of both together is this antipode, which is something like an inverse symmetry or an antiparticle. But also those tensors themselves have some interpretation of kind of dual particle or dual representations, but that's maybe physically less clear. What is more clear again is the tensors with three legs. So this multiplication is nothing but a concatenation of symmetry operation. But in terms of particle, so if you put here, go to the basis where this is block diagonal and put here one single block to one indices, then I just get two twice the same block at the other two indices, because the blocks don't mix in the block diagonal form. So if I put in here one particle, then the particle just gets copied. And the co-multiplication is nothing but fusion of particles, so creating them on top of each other. And in terms of symmetry, it just means that you copy some symmetry operation. Okay, now that's what the axioms look like in this cyclic symmetric language. So if I have a bunch of algebra elements, so let's assume they are symmetries, and you multiply them all together, then this is just this one tensor that multiplies them all together, and it doesn't matter here in which kind of exact way I multiply them together. So it doesn't matter if I first multiply C, D, and E, and then multiply this with A, B, or if I would have here, like first multiply E with A, and then multiply this with B, C, and D, or so on. So this is just associativity in the end. Yeah.
This really looks like the spider's theorem from categorical quantum.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah, this is exactly this, just on a linear algebra level here. Yeah. And then you need one more additional axiom, which is if I put this adjoint operation to all legs of some of the tensors, then the tensor gets flipped. So the with the three-leg tensor, the order of indices gets reversed. And those two axioms together make the set of those algebra tensors actually already a C-star algebra. And the same I have for the co-algebra tensors. So those adjoints in between I have to put to be able to contract again. And then in addition to those, I also have this axioms involving both the algebra and the co-algebra structure. And they all have this form down here. So they all have like n copies of the co-algebra tensors at the bottom and m copies of the algebra tensors at the top. And those are all connected with each other. And this is equal to just one algebra tensor at the bottom and one co-algebra tensor at the top with the appropriate number of indices, just that I can equate them. So for example, if I put n and m equals 2, yeah?
Just to clarify, these are axioms, not deductions from the stuff you had earlier. You're asking for this.
That's kind of a different language, a slightly different notation for the same thing. So those axioms are exactly equivalent to the axioms I presented for the standard notation just a few slides ago. So this is directly, you see, it is directly equivalent to this bi-algebra axiom that the delta is an algebra map. This is the axiom here that the two adjoint operations commute. So in the conventional language, this would be something that follows from having a C-star algebra. Here, I just take it as an axiom, for example. This here would be this compatibility that the adjoint commutes with the co-multiplication, just the other way around now. This axiom just means that copying the trivial particle here yields twice the trivial particle. Here, this axiom, so this on the left, this blank space is just the number one. This just means that there is exactly one trivial symmetry operation, or in the other way, that there is exactly one trivial particle. Okay. And then we know from today morning that every group defines a Hopf algebra. And it turns out that it can even be equipped with a C-star structure. And the corresponding tensors would look like the following. So the co-algebra tensor would just be a delta tensor that is one if all of the indices that label group elements are the same. And the algebra tensor would be just the tensor that is one if the product of group elements equals the identical group element and zero otherwise. And I can also like view it the other way around and start with the discrete group axioms, and then I can view kind of those Hopf-C-star algebra axioms as a linearization of the group axioms. Okay, so far I've only been talking about symmetry operation and excitations abstractly, but now we also need something to act with the symmetry operation on some physical space, and this is done via representation. So representation is nothing but a linear map from the algebra to the operators of some state space. So it's some tensor R, which has one index in the algebra vector space, and two indices that are both in the representation vector space that then label the operator that is represented. And the representation has to fulfill the following axioms. So if you take the representation of two different algebra elements here, and then I contract over the corresponding matrix indices, so I multiply the two operators. This is the same, then first multiplying the two algebra elements together, and then taking the representation of this thing. So the definition of a representation only involves the algebra structure, but it turns out that the co-algebra is very closely connected to representations as well, because it tells you how to simultaneously act on different representations with the same algebra element. So if I have two representations, R1 and R2, but only one algebra element, so two representations of the same algebra, but only one algebra element I want to act with simultaneously on those two kind of spots, then I need to copy the corresponding symmetry operation with this copying tensor and feed it both into R1 and R2. And that's what is also called the tensor product of representations. And also this adjoint map is nothing but the dual representation, and the co-unit is nothing but the trivial representation, which I did not put here. And in the quantum doubles, our symmetry will act in a very special way, namely via regular representation. So the regular representation is this representation where the representation vector space can be identified with the vector space of the algebra itself. And then the way how this R operator acts is just by the algebra multiplication itself. And the only thing I have to do is I have to kind of convert this index again into an output index. So this is nothing but left multiplication in the algebra vector space. Or if I first put this adjoint operation and then multiply by implicitly putting then again the output operation, then this is nothing but multiplying from the right with the adjoint. Okay, now we're finally equipped with everything we need to consider the quantum double models. And the general framework in which I will kind of view the quantum double models is I will consider them as quantum spin systems that have local symmetries, that is, local representations of some Hopsi star algebra. So representation that only act on small regions in my my space of physical indices. And I will make a very strong assumption that all of those symmetries commute with each other. And then I can kind of define the ground state as a state that is invariant under all of those symmetries. And I also get a Hamiltonian, namely simply the negative sum of all of the local projectors of the symmetry representations. So I do some slight shift from the Hamiltonian to put the symmetries more into the focus. So now what I can do, so following, I can consider the product of all of the local representations, but this time not the tensor product, so I will not act simultaneously with one algebra element at all different places, but I will choose one different algebra for each single representation. And then this product can be interpreted as one big representation of one huge algebra, which is just the tensor product of all of the local symmetry algebras. And then because the total many-body state space is now a representation of this huge algebra, I can decompose it into irreducible subspaces. So I can write the total many-body vector space as direct sum of irreducible components labeled by some IRAP alpha and by some multiplicity index m. And because this curly G is just a tensor product of many components, the IRAPs will be lists of labels, one IRAP for each single component. And this M then will be this famous topological vector space that kind of both contains this ground state degeneracy depending on the topology of the surface, and also this additional degeneracy that I get if I have multiple excitation then can fuse in different ways to the trivial excitation. Okay, so in the quantum doubles, I have spins associated to the edges of some lattice, some two-dimensional lattice, and the local vector spaces will just be equivalent to the vector space of some Hopf-Seestar algebra G. And then I have two kinds of symmetries. So first, at every plug head of the lattice, so this is the lattice here, the dashed lines are the dual lattice. For every plug head, I have one representation of the Hopf-Seestar algebra G itself that acts on all edges around the plug head. So it's a representation that takes one algebra element and maps it to an operator on, in this case, those five indices. And well, what the operator looks like is given here by this tensor network to the right. So if I put here some symmetry operation x, then it gets copied multiple times, and I have one copy for each single edge. And then on each edge, I take this copy and act with a regular representation on the edge. And whether this will be a right regular or left regular representation depends on additional orientation I have to put there on the lattice, and whether I have there an additional co-adjoint operation depends on orientation I have to put on the dual lattice. So in total, the thing is just a tensor product of regular representations. So if I look at this for the example of a group algebra, I will just take this group element x, then literally make many copies of this group element, and then multiply this group element to each single spin on the edges around. Okay, and then I also have the exact dual, namely the vertex symmetry. The vertex symmetry acts now on the plug heads of the dual lattice, or equivalently of the vertices of the lattice. And well, it's the exact dual thing, so it's a representation of the dual of G, so the dual of a Hopf algebra with the Hopf algebra with the co-algebra part and the algebra part exchanged. Well, and the way it acts is just the opposite. So if you I replace here every algebra tensor by the corresponding co-algebra tensor, then I get the vertex part. So here you nicely see this duality. So for a group, those tensors here would simply multiply, would simply copy each group element at each spin. And then this tensor in the middle will ensure that the product of all group elements around equals the group element x. So it's nothing but projecting onto the subspace of where the product of group elements around the vertex equals the group element x. Now you might already see that the vertex operator is not already fully specified by giving a vertex, because it might, whether I start here multiplying at B and stop at A, or whether I start multiplying at A and stop at E, might yield different results at x. So the position of this red index here matters, and it also matters for the plug-head terms if my co-algebra tensors are not commutative. So in order to specify one symmetry representation, I not only have to specify the vertex, but also the position of this red index between two edges, so it can be specified by giving one neighboring plug-head. So representations are actually correspond to pairs of vertices and neighboring plug-heads, which are so-called sites. But what does not depend on some position of some right index is the ground state projector, which I get from taking the trivial particle and feeding it into the representation. Then I get the ground state projector up to some normalization factor. Because then I can simply fuse the ground state projector into the central tensor here, the trivial particle into the central tensor here. And I get this tensor network, which obviously does not have any dependence on some red index. Okay, now to apply the analysis from the slide before, I want commuting representations. So let's consider the commutation properties of them. So first of all, any pair of two vertex representations or any pair of two plaquette representations, they always commute because either they don't overlap, then it's trivial, or they overlap at exactly one edge, and then it suffices to only consider the action onto this single edge. So if I have some edge A and I first act on it from the plaquette operator to its right, and then afterwards act on it with the plaquette operator to its left, then it's the same than doing this in the other order. Because the dependence, whether I have right or left regular representation on the orientations, will always be such that here I have one right and one left regular representation, and they commute. You can also see this by those abstract axioms, by the fact that you can fuse those tensors together and then split them up again, and this will be the same. The situation is a bit okay. The same thing I also, of course, have for the vertex part. Situation is a bit more involved when I consider pairs of plaquette and vertex representations. So like some lattice part here. So here I have one vertex and the neighboring plaquette to its right. Then they overlap at two edges. So vertex and plaquette either overlap not at all or they overlap at two edges. And if they do so, then it suffices to only consider the action on those two overlapping edges. So here I first apply the vertex operator with some algebra element x to those two common edges A and B, and then I apply the plaquette operator with its plaquette to its right with some algebra element y, and then I can use those mutual Hopf algebra axioms to kind of pull this algebra tensor through here. Then I kind of get some additional interaction between those two indices, and the same happens for the other spin, and those two kind of cancel. So I can interchange those, and they commute. But the situation is that now it depends on this location of the red index. Because if this red index for one, either the plaquette or the vertex term, or even both, is such that it is in between of the two overlapping indices, then those two actions from the A and B cannot cancel anymore. And those vertex and plaquette operators actually do not commute anymore. So what I can do now is I can still simply consider the product of one vertex and one plaquette term, and in such a way that kind of both of the red indices are located between the overlapping edges. And as they do not commute, this is obviously not anymore a representation of just the tensor product of G and the dual of G. But this is I'm lucky, and this is a tensor product, it's a representation of something else, namely of the quantum double. And this quantum double is again Hopf algebra. So it has a co-algebra part and an algebra part. And because I kind of don't want to change the way I act simultaneously on different places, because of that, the co-algebra part is simply given by the tensor product of the co-algebra part of G and the algebra and the co-algebra part of the dual of G, which is nothing but the algebra part of G. But the algebra tensors are somewhat different. So if you forget for a moment about those Brown tensors here, then it still would be just the tensor product of the algebra of G and the algebra of the dual of G. But now, because they don't interact, I get some interaction between the algebra component, between the G component and the dual G component. And this interaction looked like the Brown tensors here. So if you quickly think about the example of a group algebra, then this would take two copies of this group element x prime here, and then multiply twice by this copy. And because there is some additional adjointness stuff involved, this is nothing but a conjugation of the G of the G dual G component with the G component. And in general case, it would be something like a mutual conjugation of those two components. Okay, and now I got a new symmetry algebra of which I have a representation. And well, now my violations of this new symmetry, I can again interpret as particles. So the particles corresponding to this quantum double symmetries are nothing but the irreducible representation of this quantum double algebra. And this algebra actually is not only a Hopf-Sestar algebra, it has some additional property, which is called quasi-triangularity. And this means that I have this R matrix that admits doing braiding of the excitations in the end. Okay. So, so far, I told you I did kind of defined excitations. But another interesting question is, how do I actually create excitations on top of the ground state? So suppose we have some lattice, which I have a part of here. And I want to create one particle-antiparticle pair of vertex violations. Like on those two vertices here and here, then what I would have to do in the toric code is simply choose some arbitrary path that connects them and flip all spins along that path. And the generalization to the quantum doubles is given by this tensor network here below. So if I feed in here the kind of particle excitation that I want to create a pair of, then what I get out is an operator acting on those three spins here along this blue path between the places of the excitations. And what this operator, what this tensor network does, it just copies this excitations multiple times for each spin, and then has a regular representation at each spin. And if you look closely, then this is just kind of the dual thing to the vertex symmetry operator itself, because this is a representation of the algebra G and acting along some path in the lattice, whereas the vertex symmetry operation is was a representation of the dual of G, which involved all spins around the vertex, so which acted along a path in the dual lattice. And the complete analog is for when I create two plucket excitations, then I have to choose some path in the dual lattice connecting them and apply this dual operator. But now I told you that in order to consider the most general kind of excitations, I have to consider violations of vertex and plucket at the same time. So if I want to create a pair of vertex plucket excitations at those two neighboring sites, then I have to act on some 1D region between them, which is called a ribbon. And the ribbon is nothing but a path in the lattice and at the same time a path in the dual lattice such that the dual path is always right next to the direct path. And the operator which I have to act is given by this tensor network below. So here I have to feed in one element of the, so one excitation of the quantum double algebra, which then gets copied for each of the edges that occurs in the ribbon. And for each edge, I have like a regular representation. But of course, so this is kind of abbreviated notation because I cannot really feed in this double index into the algebra tensor of G. So what this actually does, it just throws away one of the two components by closing it with the unit or the co-unit, and then acts with the regular representation with the other part. And the order in which the representation occur here is just the order in which edges occur in this ribbon. Okay, and I can also interpret those 1D creation operators as just creating one pair of particle-antiparticle and then moving the second particle around. Now imagine I create one pair and move the second part around and back to its antiparticle and then annihilate those. Then what I get is a closed ribbon operator. So something with just some central quantum double algebra tensor in the middle that copies this excitation and then acts with the ribbon around it. And if I have such a process that creates a particle and then annihilates it again, I should end up with the ground state again. So it should not be visible where I actually started. So this position of the red index here should not be visible. So, and this is exactly the case if we take for this an element of the center of the quantum double algebra. So if I, and those elements of the center are nothing but the particles. So this is the basis of particles. And if I put here an element of the center, then of course it commutes through without changing anything. And that's also another way how you can see that particles should be correspond to the irreducible blocks of the quantum double algebra. Okay, so in total we've seen that to consider the most general particles in the quantum double models, we have to consider both Plucket and vertex symmetries together, and then those kinds of particles are described by the algebra that corresponds to this product, which is the quantum double algebra. And if I want to create those excitations, then I have to act along a ribbon connecting them. Okay, so this was everything from my side. Thanks for listening. Again, special case
are of these what? Models are special Gesus-dependent models, or are they?
Yes, they are. So, so if I take those models for weak quantum doubles, for weak Hopf algebras, then they are exactly equivalent to at least the Stringer models with tetrahedral symmetry. Mm-hmm. But Hopf algebras are a specific case of weak Hopf algebras. So
what do you gain by looking at Hopf algebras? Models that come from Hopf algebras rather than string net models?
Not really much. I mean, the connection to symmetry is a bit clearer because, like for Hopf algebra, the co-unit is the trivial representation. For weak Hopf algebras, you don't have this interpretation anymore. The co-unit does not have to be a representation, for example. Such things you bit have to give up, but there is, I mean, you can easily generalize to. So there's not much you gain by looking at the special case, in my opinion. Just that the axioms are maybe a little bit more simpler. But, yeah.
So, again, following the same question, this equivalence that you mentioned, does it depend on some mathematical theory? So, would like to know the reference to that.
It depends on some mathematical theory. I mean, this equivalence is more or less the same that the equivalence between fusion categories and quantum doubles, which we heard about this morning, actually. This goes along the same lines.
So the strings and the ribbons you were talking about are to create a pair of excitations, is that right?
Yeah, so the all excitations in one closed surface always have to fuse to the trivial charge. So you can only create one pair of excitations, it's the smallest thing you can.
Right, but you can also have a ribbon that will move an excitation to a different place with the same.
Yeah, so this will exactly be applying a ribbon to a state where there already exists one excitation at some point. And then if you multiply with a ribbon that creates the antiparticle of the particle that already exists at this point, they will just fuse to.
The particle and antiparticle is so automatically fused to vacuum, do they? I mean, there's vacuums in the
Yeah, I mean, they. I mean, in general, the particle antiparticle do not have to fuse to true particle. Yeah, that's true. So, yeah, kind of. Yeah, it's not that simple. Yeah, right. So, if you have some particle here, then you kind of have to know how to continue with the ribbon operator from this. Yeah.
Right. So, I guess my question was, is there a way to, like, turn stuff around to make your ribbon operator do that?
I mean, in order to kind of move some particle further, you have to know how it was created.
Right.
So, if you just say there is a particle of type XY at this point, just from this information, I cannot write down the ribbon operator that will move it further away because.
You could do the first ribbon operator and project it vacuum at the site where you can vacuum.
Yeah, I guess that's what one could do. I guess one could also kind of be unlucky and choose a ribbon operator that has zero projection on the vacuum state on there if you continue with that one. But yeah, in general, this would be, yeah, it should work. Yeah.
Do you know if these opsies or algebras whether they are also von Neumann?
No, I don't know what von Neumann algebras are, so sorry.
Finite-dimensional, right?
Sorry?
This is all finite-dimensional, right?
Yeah, okay, so my question was about if the number of lattice sites is infinite, then they're not necessarily finite-dimensional.
In finite-dimensional, I think von Neumann algebra, it's all the same,
So the question was, the question that I wanted to ask was if the number of lattice sites is infinite.
The number of lattice sites is something different than the local dimension of the Hopf algebra.
Right.
I mean, the number of lattice sites I also consider finite, but it could be kind of any amount. I could scale it up in the end. But this does not correspond to, I mean, this is different, totally different thing from the local dimension of the local.
But it is finite. It can be any finite number, but it is finite.
You
do not describe infinite.
Yeah, I mean, in principle, you could do this quantum spin system, see star algebra construction if you want.
You have to look at the right definition
of
the
other maps. Yeah. Is the operation to give any positive definite in that product?
Yes, I guess so.
Did you have to? Would you describe non-unitary systems?
In this case, actually, everything is always. I guess it always has to be like positive definite. Yeah.
Can I, sorry, just to pick up from a comment that was made during your talk. The objects that you defined in the beginning seem to be relatively closely related to Dagger Frobenius algebras. So is there a reason you choose not to use those constructions?
Again,
you have defined these multiplication and unit and antipode and like multiplication. And then you've imposed certain axioms. And those are related to the axioms that characterize Dagger Frobenius algebras. And in fact, by algebras and strongly complementary pairs of Dagger Frobenius algebras, which are well understood and have lots of like nice properties, including, for example, the connection to sister algebras.
Okay, so maybe I should have a closer look at Frobenius algebra.
Yeah, I was just wondering whether there's some specific to this construction that forces you to use a slightly different object, or whether it's just a matter of notation.
Yeah, I don't know exactly so far what Frobenius algebras are exactly, but I came across this notion multiple times. Maybe I should have a closer look at it.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, any more questions? Okay, that's 10 minutes right there.